is traveling into the central business district zone, which is what the congestion pricing plan affects, are higher income. 83% are higher moderate income. So that means if you look at the statistics for how low income New Yorkers are traveling into lower Manhattan, for every one New Yorker who might be traveling via car into the central business district, there are 50 who are waiting for a delayed subway, waiting for a delayed bus. Every New Yorker has a story of waiting for a bus or subway for extreme amounts of time. And the solution to affordability in New York, as the governor has herself been saying for 50 years, is not canceling congestion pricing. It's funding the MTA. It's giving us reliability. It's giving us accessible subway stations. That's really what congestion pricing is about. It's about what future do we want for New Yorkers. Is it one where we have reliable subway? Is it one where we have air that we can breathe without getting asthma? Is it one of climate and environmental justice? Or is it one where we have to wait on hours in gridlock traffic?
Keanu Arpels Josiah, we want to thank you for being with us. That does it for this show. Climate activist and organizer with Fridays for Future NYC. And we want to thank David Jones, sorry for the connection problems, MTA board member and president of Community Service Society of New York. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The month of June is Pride Month, an opportunity to shine a light on the vast heritage of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, unquestioning, intersex, asexual, or agender, as well as two-spirit community members. Here at KBOO, we will be celebrating LGBTQIA2S+ heritage on Tuesdays, 7 to 8 p.m., with live panels from our studios, where we will have guests from these communities talk to us about their culture, presence, struggles, and relevance. Tune in to KBOO every Tuesday throughout the month of June and into July, 7 to 8 p.m., and join us in celebrating LGBTQIA2S+ heritage with our special Pride Month live panels. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland will start enforcing its new homeless campaign ban on July 1st. The amusement park ride that trapped people upside down 50 feet in the air for half an hour is back in operation. And advocates launch a campaign in Washington to improve pay for classified school staff. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 25, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler will enforce the newest ban on homeless camps starting this coming Monday, July 1st. It allows the city to fine or jail unhoused people if there are shelter beds available and those folks don't agree to go. It was adopted by City Council in early May. Unhoused Portlanders who are found to be camping outside can be punished with a $100 fine or 7 days in jail. The shelter bed refusal is a key component of the city's claim to the law's legitimacy. An earlier camping ban was stopped by a court in November because it didn't meet the criteria in court precedent and in state law that rules about camping must be objectively reasonable. Those laws also require that cities can't sweep people from the street if they don't have anywhere else to go. Portland and Multnomah County have far fewer shelter beds to offer than there are people currently experiencing homelessness in the area. The new tactic the city is taking is creating an app for outreach workers to see in real time which shelter beds are available. They plan to go to camps the city deems problematic and offer a shelter bed in real time. If the person refuses, they can be jailed or fined. Wheeler says the city has been getting the word out to people for the last month about the new rules. The ordinance also has restrictions on how, where, and when people can camp in the city if there are no shelter beds available. This comes as a decision in the Supreme Court case Grants Pass versus Johnson is expected in the next couple of days. The Supreme Court will rule on an earlier decision that held that people can't be punished for being homeless if they have nowhere else to go. That decision held that for a government to punish that person would be cruel and unusual punishment, which is not allowed under the Eighth Amendment. The last camping ban was stopped by a court injunction on the day it was first to be enforced. The same could be true of the upcoming enforcement of this ban once it goes into effect. Workers at schools known as classified staff, people other than teachers who help schools run, are low paid and often have to work multiple jobs to get by. A campaign has been launched in Washington State to increase their wages. Eric Tagadoff has more on the story.
Workers who help Washington State classrooms run are calling for higher wages. Known as classified staff, their jobs include administrative work, transportation, and custodial services. Unions representing workers, including the American Federation of Teachers of Washington and Washington Education Association, have launched a wage campaign to increase pay for these workers. Anitra Wise works with the Tacoma School District as a paraeducator, helping teachers in the classroom. She says her wages simply aren't enough.
We have to work 2 and 3 different jobs just to catch up with the cost of living, including housing, groceries, and things that we need to survive.
With Washington State school districts out for summer, classified staff members face another challenge, the suspension of their low wages. Wise says she's working at summer school this year.
We have to supplement that income somehow, and I really don't get a summer because I have to work just to supplement my income.
Wise says classified staff have many important jobs, including the work she does as a paraeducator in the classroom.
We're the glue that keep it together, do all the small jobs and the big jobs too, because without the team of paraeducators, the teachers would not be able to teach. And paraeducators are teachers also.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The ride at Portland's Oaks Amusement Park that trapped riders upside down 50 feet in the air for half an hour is back up in operation less than 2 weeks since the incident. Oaks Park says they completed a full inspection and the maker of the ride found no mechanical, technical, or maintenance issues. They also say the incident wasn't caused by the person operating the ride either, so it's not clear what happened to trap those 28 people upside down. The park says they won't allow the pendulum-style ride to rotate 360 degrees anymore after the incident. It will only operate in 180 or 260-degree modes. This comes as Oaks Park is facing at least one lawsuit for the incident on June 14th. The mother of one of the trapped riders filed a $125,000 lawsuit on behalf of her 14-year-old daughter last week. More lawsuits could be on the way. Charges against fake electors in Nevada are dismissed. Milwaukee officials get ready to expect the unexpected at the RNC convention. And the Justice Department says Alaska is violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're willing to hire the best attorneys to fight them in court. With all the shenanigans they're playing, with all the anomalies we've seen happen.
Nevada Republican Party Chair Michael McDonald had vowed to fight the criminal charges he tried to overturn former President Donald Trump's 2020 loss in the state. The fake electors case against McDonald and 5 others has been dismissed by a state judge, saying prosecutors filed in the wrong county. Democrats say they want to appeal. Courts in Arizona, Georgia, and Michigan are considering similar cases. Officials in Milwaukee say people will be allowed to carry guns within blocks of the Republican National Convention next month. U.S. Secret Service Director Kimberly Cheadle says local officials can't alter Wisconsin gun laws for the event, but weapons will be banned within the convention's perimeter.
Previous experience and extensive preparation all contribute to a level of confidence ahead of this convention. We have been busy preparing for any possible scenario, including planned and pop-up demonstrations.
Protesters have been offered two outdoor stages, one within sight of the convention arena. More than 100 organizations have applied to demonstrate so far. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has vetoed a bill making it illegal to wear a mask in public, but for reasons tied to campaign finance. Democratic State Representative Tim Longest says an amendment to the bill would undo some limits on dark money groups.
Billionaire donors who want to buy our state elections, but who don't want the public to know what they are doing or who they are giving to, will be able to use these out-of-state entities to funnel money to the committees of these top candidates.
Democrats say the changes are meant to bolster fundraising for the GOP's far-right gubernatorial candidate, Mark Robinson, who has so far raised only half as much as his Democratic opponent. While House Republicans make claims about non-citizens voting in federal elections, some right-wing groups are targeting municipalities that do let them cast ballots in local races. A new lawsuit claims Burlington is violating the Vermont Constitution by letting non-citizens vote in school board races, but State Representative Hal Colston says both the legislature and a majority of voters approved the law.
This is the local control that Vermont champions. This is the local democracy that other states covet.
The Justice Department says the state of Alaska is violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by not providing accessible voting machines or polling places. Kenai, Alaska resident Maggie Winston tells Alaska News Source that often means a lack of privacy for voters with physical challenges.
It would be great as an adult to be able to independently vote without having to tell someone who I'm voting for.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Indigenous Women's Resource Center celebrated the recent Supreme Court decision to uphold a ban on domestic abusers owning firearms. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Indigenous Women's Resource Center is applauding the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in United States versus Rahimi to uphold the federal statute that prohibits individuals subject to a domestic violence restraining order from possessing a firearm. The Resource Center filed an amicus brief last year urging the court to uphold the protections to keep domestic abusers from accessing guns. Executive Director Lucy Simpson in a statement said, "Survivors are often in the most danger when they attempt to leave an abuser or when they receive an order of protection. So prohibiting the possession of a firearm for those subject to a domestic violence protection order is a critical safeguard." And she says work needs to be done to fully address gaps in protections for survivors, including by closing the boyfriend dating partner loophole, which allows dating partners subject to protection orders to possess firearms. Statistics show American Indian and Alaska Native women experience the highest rates of violence in the country, with 4 in 5 women experiencing violence in their lifetime. According to the Resource Center, firearms are the most common cause of intimate partner violence homicide injury for American Indian and Alaska Native people. The court ruled 8-1 in the case. The National American Indian Housing Council kicked off its 50th convention and trade show Monday at the Seminole Hard Rock Hotel in Hollywood, Florida. More than 600 people from across the country are registered for the 4-day event. Tribal leaders and tribal housing officials are among attendees. Discussions include the reauthorization of the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act of 1996, known as NAHASDA. The law governs development, operation, and maintenance of homes for the 574 federally recognized tribes. National American Indian Housing Council Executive Director Douglas Marconi Sr. says it's important for Congress to understand how critical funding is for much-needed homes in Native communities. He says looking back at 50 years of housing in Indian country, there are great strides, but communities have growing needs, and Indian housing has always been underfunded. On Tuesday, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. will highlight his tribe's investment in housing initiatives, including housing for elders. He's expected to also address the reauthorization of NAHASDA. NAHASDA grants provide affordable housing that benefit low-income families living on Indian reservations and Alaska Native communities. Reauthorization of the law has been delayed since 2013, and the bill is now facing funding cuts. The Committee on Appropriations Subcommittee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development is expected to review the bill this summer. Tribal leaders are advocating for its reauthorization and are seeking increased funding. Native people from around the country are honoring the birth of a rare white bison calf in Yellowstone National Park this week. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports, many see it as a blessing and a warning.
The white bison calf made international headlines when it was spotted in Yellowstone earlier this month. While not confirmed by park staff, tribal members say it's the first documented wild bison of its kind. Other white bison have been born in captivity to parents with cow DNA. This birth fulfills a prophecy for many tribes. Lakota chief Arvo Looking Horse has compared it to the second coming of Jesus Christ. But he has also said it's a sign that more needs to be done to protect the animals and the earth. Looking Horse will lead a gathering Wednesday morning in West Yellowstone, honoring and naming the rare bison. This comes as Yellowstone National Park proposes big changes in how it manages the species. There's currently about 5,000 bison in the park, and that number could go up to 6. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in depth. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, a panel discussion amongst LGBTQ plus youth broadcast live from the KABU studios in honor of Pride Month. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a daytime high of 73. Today in history, in 1978, the rainbow flag representing gay pride is flown for the first time during the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day parade. The quote of the day is from American chef and author Anthony Bourdain, born this day in 1956. He said, quote, "It seems that the more places I see and experience, the bigger I realize the world to be. The more I become aware of, the more I realize how relatively little I know of it, how many places I still have to go, how much more there is to learn. Maybe that's enlightenment enough. To know that there is no final resting place of the mind, no moment of smug clarity, perhaps wisdom, at least for me, means realizing how small I am and unwise, and how far I have yet to go." This is World Ocean Month, and groups that advocate for clean air and curbing climate change are asking President Joe Biden to order the shipping industry to cut pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. Suzanne Potter reports from California.
June is World Ocean Month, and groups that fight climate change are asking President Joe Biden to act to clean up emissions and pollution from the shipping industry. Advocates have been meeting with White House officials since last fall, making the case for an executive order to decarbonize maritime shipping, which largely runs on what they describe as dirty diesel fuel. Teresa Bowie is climate policy director for the group Pacific Environment.
We're asking President Biden to use the Clean Air Act authority to help establish goal-based fuel standards for ships to reduce shipping emission by 100% by 2040.
Opponents in the shipping industry say electrifying ships would carry a big price tag and raise the cost of goods. Advocates counter that the price increases would be minimal compared to the benefits of cleaner air. Groups are also asking the feds to monitor the fuels on ships coming to U.S. ports to get better pollution data. And they want to mandate that ports bring greenhouse gas emissions and pollution to zero by the year 2030. Bowie says a 2019 community health study showed people in communities near the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles experience up to 8 years lower life expectancy than the Los Angeles County average.
Black Long Beach residents are hospitalized with asthma at least 8 times the rate, and Latinx residents at twice the rate of white Long Beach residents.
She says they also want the Biden administration to pursue more green shipping corridors and phase out the use of sulfur scrubber ships in U.S. waters. They're used to remove sulfur from ship exhaust but release contaminants into the water. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Bureau of Land Management has completed its environmental impact statement on 382,000 acres of public lands in Northwest California, which will lead to a management plan for the pristine wilderness area. Mark Richardson has more.
Conservation advocates say a new Bureau of Land Management final environmental impact statement takes positive steps toward developing a management plan to conserve public lands in Northwest California. The Northwest California Integrated Resource Management Plan will manage more than 380,000 acres in Mendocino, Humboldt, Trinity, Siskiyou, Shasta, Butte, and Tahoma counties for at least the next two decades. John Hishek with the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors says the plan will help protect both endangered habitat and at-risk communities from the impacts of climate change, including wildfire.
It provides some protections for some of these areas that are very sensitive, like Eden Valley, which is very environmentally fragile areas, and then also the Eel River. It's a wild and scenic river. So just making sure that these are managed properly is very important.
The lands covered by the plan stretch from the North Coast to the Central Valley and the foothills of the Sierra Madre Mountains. They include isolated redwood groves, oak woodlands, rivers and streams, and are home to elk, bald eagles, sandhill cranes, salmon, and steelhead. BLM officials say the plan is a collaborative effort of communities, tribes, local governments, and other partners. The BLM's final plan establishes management areas to protect recreational uses, including miles of trails for hikers, hunters, anglers, mountain bikers, and equestrians, as well as some of the best non-expert canoeing and kayaking in California. Steve O'Brien, who manages a bicycle shop in Chico, says he has several decades of experience in the region, and he hopes the management plan will keep it in pristine condition.
I'm pleased to have been a part or have some effect on this decision to preserve the land, because I've gotten to utilize it most of my life, and we need to make concerted effort to conserve some wild spots for the future generations that are headed our way.
A BLM spokesman says the plan will address changing use patterns, provide a broad array of recreation uses, plans for wilderness management, and will protect wild and scenic rivers and areas of critical environmental concern. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For California News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
When we hear about hurricanes, they're described by different categories of severity. But what do the different categories mean? Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As a hurricane gains strength over the ocean, the wind starts to blow faster and faster. These wind speeds determine how meteorologists rank the storm's power. Cyclones with lower wind speeds are called tropical storms or tropical depressions. But once the wind reaches 74 miles per hour, it becomes a Category 1 hurricane. As the wind speeds up, the storm hits Category 2, then Categories 3 and 4, which are considered major hurricanes that can cause severe damage. The highest category is 5, with wind speeds over 156 miles per hour. These storms can lead to widespread destruction, weeks-long power outages, and months or years of recovery. As climate change warms the planet, scientists expect to see more hurricanes reach Category 4 or higher. But because these categories only reflect wind speed, they do not capture the full extent of a storm's potential danger. For example, Superstorm Sandy hit the Northeast with only Category 1 wind speeds, but its powerful storm surge flooded New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut with a devastating wall of water. So it's important to take all hurricanes seriously and stay alert for warnings and evacuation orders. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The just-concluded European Parliament elections did not result in a blazing victory for the far right. The center held. But at the national level, right-wing parties did score major successes in France, Germany, and Italy. The French situation especially bears watching. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone.
When it comes to paying attention to international news, Americans are notorious for focusing on wars, bad economic news, and not much else. That's unfortunate, since the recently completed elections in the 27 European Union countries for a European Parliament do impact the U.S. government and its citizens. The issues in the European Parliament elections were the Ukraine war, immigration, and the costs of a green transition. But the transcendent issue, there as here, is anti-democracy versus pro-democracy constitutional rule, which is to say the far right versus the left to center right. The voting, which takes place every 5 years, was for 720 seats, with the winning parties in each country gaining a proportion of seats in the parliament. The parliament is organized into seven groups by political leanings, not nationality. Examining the results for these seven groups, we find that the right-wing parties won about 150 seats, but they don't all belong to the same political group, limiting their power. On the other hand, the three leading conservative and liberal groups, while they together lost 17 seats compared to 5 years ago, altogether won 400 seats. They have the best chance of forming a coalition and staying the majority group in parliament. That's why European Union Commission head Ursula von der Leyen said, quote, "The center is holding, though extremists have gained great support." Indeed, although headlines here and abroad highlighted a huge right-wing populist victory, the figures indicate that center-left and center-right parties still constitute a majority in the European Parliament. But when we look at the results at the national level, far-right parties have scored the biggest gains, notably in Germany, Italy, and especially France. In Germany, Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats suffered a major defeat, winning just 14% of the vote. The far-right AfD, the Alternative for Germany, got 16.5%, and the Christian Democrats 29.5%. And in Italy, right-wing leader Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy party came out on top with about 29% of the vote, a major gain of 14 seats. The French situation is particularly concerning. Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party got 31.5% of the vote to President Emmanuel Macron's Renaissance Party's 15.2%. That glaring defeat led Macron to dissolve the National Assembly and call for a snap election, a strategy he characterized as an unpinned grenade. Apparently, Macron is banking on the National Rally winning but proving incompetent at governing. It's a plan many in France believe will backfire. Early polls show the far right well ahead in new parliament elections, with the leftist party second. Macron's popularity has fallen to a five-year low. France faces a debt crisis, bonds and equities are tumbling, and its economy is limping along even more slowly than Britain's. Nevertheless, Macron is banking on two things. First, a massive show of strength in the streets against the far right, which is already happening. Second, formation of a coalition with other centrist parties. "Things are simple today," he said. "We have unnatural alliances at both extremes who will not be able to implement any program." He vows to stay in office through his term, which ends in 2027, no matter what. As he said after calling for the snap election, quote, "Everybody sees the floodwaters of the far right rising. Everybody is saying Macron will hand them the keys of power. I don't want to give them the keys to power in 2027, unquote. The election will be held in two rounds, June 30th and July 7th. So far, the political situation since the snap election announcement is chaotic. Even if the far right gains the number one position in parliament, it will still not be able to govern by itself. Le Pen's National Rally is therefore trying to bring a center-right party, Les Républicains, into the fold, but is facing resistance. Leftist parties are coming together against all sides with a worker-friendly program that includes tying wages to inflation, a wealth tax on the rich, and a lower retirement age. There were some pleasant surprises elsewhere. In Hungary, far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's party lost ground. In Poland, the new Prime Minister Donald Tusk's party defeated a right-wing party. And in the Netherlands, the Green Links party came in first. To sum up, Europe does not yet face a political crisis on the order of Winston Churchill's famous Iron Curtain speech, but right-wing politics is widely popular and gaining strength in nearly every major electoral contest so far. We'll know more, and very soon, by watching the outcome in France. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 25, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuchner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Willie Levinson, the founder of Human Access Project, to talk about some upcoming events on the Willamette River, the Cathedral Park River Fest, and Human Access Project Swim Week. Welcome to the show, Willie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. So your organization is dedicated to improving public access to the Willamette River. Can you tell me a little bit about how that kind of work got started?
Sure. So the mission of Human Access Project is actually a little more broad. Our mission is to transform Portland's relationship with the Willamette River. So a lot of the ways we get people connected with the Willamette has been our work to improve access to the river with trails and improving riverside areas, such as, over the last 14 years, we've removed over 350